Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On today's show, the auction to buy the Telegraph Media Group is officially on, but will it be derailed before a buyer is found? Also on the programme, 50 years old and commercial radio is in rude health. If the radars are any indication, we unpack the findings. Plus, what it's really like for freelancers in the TV commissioning slowdown. We speak to one director frustrated by the way they've been treated. All that plus in the media quiz, it's time for the return of the elevator pitch. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, BBC Director General Tim Davey was grilled at the 1922 committee on Wednesday evening. It's an unusual move to meet the Conservative group who can make or break a Tory Prime Minister. The Sun's Harry Cole saw him leave, saying he looked like he needed a good pint. Meanwhile, the Beeb has told Deadline that the rebooted British version of Survivor will not be polite or apologetic. The show, which airs on Saturday, will be the first version here since it was on ITV 2 decades ago. MPA Media's Clive Marshall is to retire after 14 years in the job. Marshall has transitioned the company from a national news agency to a global digital news brand. He plans to spend more time ticking off dozens of Scottish Munro mountains. Now joining me at the London Podcast Studios, we have two intrepid explorers of the media landscape. First up, it's radio producer and consultant Anne Charles. Hello.
Hello.
Anne, it's that time of the year again.
Yes.
Radio TechCon.
Exactly. 27th of November in London. So it specialises in broadcast engineering and technology with a radio and audio focus, but we welcome everybody. So if you're interested in the future of where media is going, then it's definitely the place to be. So we've got a bit of a technical behind the scenes on how Eurovision happened.
Oh, nice.
And also the coronation, and a lovely session on how to plan your broadcast network so it doesn't get attacked by ransomware and stuff like that. We also have a bursary scheme, so we're really proud of this, and thank you very much to all of our sponsors. But it means that you can apply to come and you can have a free ticket. We'll cover your travel and accommodation if you need it, and you get a year's free membership to the Radio Academy.
That's great.
And that's available to anyone who's from a background underrepresented in broadcast engineering, or if you are facing a financial barrier. So if you're thinking, I'm not sure if TechCon's for me, then please apply. The closing date is the 5th of November, and all the information is at radiotechcon.com.
Radiotechcon.com. And alongside Anne, we welcome back journalist, writer, and all-round media provocateur. It's James Ball.
Hi there.
Did you accept that as an intro?
I think that's entirely fair. I am feeling quite provoked this week as well.
Why?
So I do think it was a bit bloody stupid of Tim Davey to agree to talk to Conservative MPs behind closed doors.
Because they say it was organised ages ago and it's just him doing the rounds.
I don't care if it was organised ages ago. He is the Director General of the BBC. It is publicly owned. It is a public broadcaster. It needs the faith of all the public. And there are means for it to talk to Parliament, and that's the DCMS committee. There's MPs of all channels there. This is going to look like a Conservative-leaning DG who's known to have some connections there, with Conservative board members speaking in a closed forum to the party of government. That is not good for the fundamental, even if he did nothing wrong.
Is it just bad staff work, though? Should they just offer Labour the same opportunity of him to come and speak to the Labour group?
They should go. If we are talking to parliamentarians, we are doing it in the open, or at least in a cross-party way.
But they do it all the time,
don't
they?
I think it was completely silly of
them. Don't they do it all the time? They'll go and meet groups of MPs, or they meet individual MPs, government or not.
They send staffers down and public policy people, and that's appropriate. They are going to have to interact with it. But I think the symbolism of your top person doing that, I think it shows too much regard to the governing party and not enough to the public, who at the moment, polling suggests, don't much trust that governing party. I just think it was a really poor lapse of judgment on his part.
It isn't the first time it's happened.
No, but even so, I think as the atmosphere is more polarised and more polemic and more angry, and as the BBC is having to really work to sort of keep our trust, and I think it deserves our trust. I say this as a fan of the BBC. I think this kind of move is just damn silly. I don't think he was malicious or malign. Yes. I mean, it is essentially he's done all of this and they're still going to sort of be furious with him. They're still going to be anti-BBC. And now they've just annoyed all the people who want to stick up for them. So,
Anne, would you turn up to an invite to the 1922 committee?
I mean, it would depend what the biscuits were being served, wouldn't it, really? When has it happened before? Because it's not something that I remember happening.
So it happened in the 80s.
Oh, okay. Well, that'll be why then.
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, this is an unusual move.
Yes.
And it was controversial in the 80s. It wasn't that everyone went, oh, well, that's fine. Of course this is appropriate.
Well, speaking of right-wing influence on media, The Telegraph. We've talked about it a bit on the show already. Last Friday, Lloyds fired up the starting pistol on the sale of The Telegraph with a number of contenders who've come forward. Anne, who is in the running?
Who isn't in the running is a better thing. So the last I saw, we have German publishers of Der Spiegel, Axel Springer. I'm sure I'm saying all of these wrong. DMGT, the Daily Mail Group, who also own the Metro. So I guess it would be an interesting move for them to have a broadsheet as well, but they're having a go. We've got Will Lewis, who's the former Telegraph editor, who presumably has some idea about how to run it. National World, who run regional newspapers. Paul Marshall, who's invested in Unheard and GB News. There's a Czech investor. Rupert Murdoch, apparently. Martin Clark, who's ex-Mail Online. And I presume to be announced today that the media podcast, as it's now visualised, is also going to look into taking over print empire. How hard can it be?
I mean, it's quite a rogues gallery. Everyone's had their own sort of issues. So literally, as you were reading that out, I was thinking Axel Springer acquired Politico, a lot of strangeness about what they'd said about covering politics in America that unseated them.
There is suspicions that it's very much controlled by one owner who was essentially given it by the widow of its founder, who was called Axel Springer. And he's got some quite strange politics that might veer into pro-Trump, but otherwise huge media empire, although beset with scandal in Germany as well over harassment by its editors, hugely successful, has invested in its newsrooms, has invested well in Politico, established in the English language, and in the UK is seen as non-partisan, and crucially actually can afford it with regular banking, which most of the rest of these can't.
So a lot of them may need some support from the Middle East.
And this seems to be the thing. You have to declare a certain amount of where your backing comes from. And very few of the other backers have any money of their own. DMGT could do it with minimal Middle Eastern money, but would hit the biggest competition problems.
But it's also their own money now, isn't it? Because the DMGT went private again,
yes,
relatively recently. And they would have to find a billion, well, maybe not quite a billion quid, but they'd have to find...
They would have to access markets, but not nearly so much as the others. The others are essentially, you know, okay, National World has some resources. It's Montgomery, who is...
Who everyone hates.
Absolutely notorious and unpopular in every newsroom. Somewhat popular with investors. He's quite good at bleeding assets dry. I can't imagine many in the Telegraph are hoping he wins, but he's a long shot. The others, you know, Will Lewis is a talented editor.
But Will Lewis is up, apparently, final two to edit the Washington Post.
Yes, I'm interested in that rumour as... I mean, I've worked at the Washington Post. As a disclosure, I should say, I write for the Telegraph. he's a very talented executive, but he's a strange front man for this. And I think somewhat distrusted still in UK newsrooms after... I mean, his role was much more cleaning up what happened with News of the World and the Sun and phone hacking, but he did have to be management's representative, and so some of that hangs over. But I think the critical problem is almost all of these players beyond DMGT, Axel... News UK is apparently more interested in The Spectator,
yes,
which would be much less likely to set off competition concerns. But there's also rumours, which actually have been reported in private eye, that there's a bit of a sort of possibility in the works that DMGT knows it would have too many newspapers, so could buy The Telegraph and sell The Eye. within the eye, again, I write for them, sorry. From what I've heard, there would be a hope, oddly, to some people listening, that they would go to Murdoch rather than to Reach.
Yes.
Because Murdoch tends to keep more money in his newspapers than Reach has been known to.
So, Anne, are we looking at some, like, monopoly board swaps?
All of this is flagging kind of Competition Commission alarm bells, especially if Daily Mail Group gets it. Although it is a profitable business, isn't it? Which is kind of unusual.
It is.
The Telegraph. I think it did 32 million last year, and its subscription efforts have been pretty good.
Yep, and actually, it could probably make more profit. You know, the Barclays were, towards the end of their ownership, quite cash-strapped, and they needed to take the full profit out of the Telegraph to prop up the rest of their businesses and their loans, which stopped working, which is why it's up for sale. Should be said, the surviving Barclay brother is also trying to put in a bid for it, isn't
he? Well, as we talked about last week, the idea you've bought it once, you're going to buy it again with new money. I mean, that's like, you really do want these papers.
It's completely surreal, but buying
newspapers has never been a sane thing.
No, but this one potentially could be. I mean, you'll pay a little more than you should, but given it's actually had chronic underinvestment for the last 10 years of its ownership and is still generating cash, there's a suggestion there's probably quite a good asset here. You know, similarly, The Spectator is seen as more of the trophy asset. It's not nearly as valuable, but The Spectator generates about a seven-figure profit each year. You know, it's a profitable magazine. It's got a good subscriber base. These are actually pretty good assets. These were the sort of crown jewels of the Barclay empire.
Well, there's also an element of right-wing cinematic universe with the GB News founder fancying the Telegraph as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I guess trying to build up a smaller but equivalent empire to what Rupert Murdoch has got. You kind of go across platforms and you have the advantage, depending on if you're allowed to work together or not, or if you have to keep things separate. But if you want influence across multiple platforms and also having something that's profitable, because I don't think GB News is not.
It's he was essentially, I think, the buyer that's causing the most alarm bells among sort of sensible centre-right types that you talk to. Because people sort of say, this is a man who's had an extensive journey in his short media ownership career. Unheard was supposed to be the sensible centre-right and hired a lot of people who did that, who worked on that. GB News was initially, as envisioned with Andrew Neil, going to be very different from where it is. And it really peddles conspiracy nonsense and all of that. And that in a broadsheet format, in papers, with the access the Telegraph has, That seems to worry people, and also I think worries people who still quite happily and proudly write for the Telegraph. Mm. You know, it might have the odd column that you think's a bit out there, but there's a good newspaper that does serious news there. And I think people are a bit worried about that one.
Will the retired colonels of Surrey go for it if that happens, though, or will they not be kicking up a fuss at them?
I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the one that always sticks out to me in terms of how much do people notice when what they're reading changes is it was more than one in six Sun readers when Kelvin McKenzie was the editor thought the paper supported Labour.
Yeah, and why should they think about it? You know, it's not the big part of their lives. We'll keep an eye on the runners and writers over the next few weeks. Something that happened yesterday was, something that was public this morning, but the radio industry found out about yesterday, was the latest listening figures. Anne, would you care to go through some headlines with me?
Yes, let's do it.
I'm excited.
Yes, I would.
Bauer's investment in greatest hits definitely continues to pay off, led by Ken Bruce. Mm-hmm. How's he done?
He has done well. Now, there is a complicated thing that Matt is better at explaining than I am around. It's very hard to compare the results between the BBC Radio 2 and Greatest Hits because they're measured over a different period of time. But broadly speaking, BBC lost over a million listeners and quite a lot of them have turned up with Ken. And he's increased his listenership compared with the last quarter. But Radio 2 in the same slot. So Vernon Kay still has more listeners than that slot for Greatest Hits. But Greatest Hits has built up its time in that area and is doing well, and presumably because of the way the measurement goes will continue to build up. So Radio 2 took the hit in the last quarter and they have that they've sort of stabilized. They haven't got those people back, but they haven't lost.
So I'm not a big radio person. How many people are we talking on Grace?
So hold on. What do you mean I'm not a big radio person? Because 88% of the population currently listens to radio, which is actually down. It's another thing I'm worried about. But you are unusual.
I listen, of course. Yeah. I'm not a monster.
Well, so for Greatest Hits, they're now up to 6.6 million listeners. They've done this through acquiring radio stations, converting radio stations, and grabbing Ken Bruce. Radio 2 remains the biggest radio station in the country. Vernon Kay now does the slot that Ken Bruce used to do, as Anne was saying, and he's got about double the audience of Ken Bruce. But the commercial impact for Bauer of becoming pretty much the number one commercial station will be very profitable for them. So they've done very well out of Ken, and as Anne says, probably a bit more to go on that too.
Because 6 million for commercial radio is enormous, isn't
it? Yeah, it's great. And where Bauer leads global, so the second biggest station is Heart. Now, of course, it's how you want to look at the figures. So in reach terms, how many people listen, Heart is number one. But the amount of time people spend with the radio station, which is where radio stations make money, Greatest Hits is larger. So they both claim the number one spot, as you often find.
Well, if you're the programme director of any radio station, when Magi comes out, your job is the day before is to find out how you are number one. It's a bit like when people say, oh, I'm number one in Amazon in, you know, best crime series involving a dog. It's like, you know, we're number one in the, like, this town for people who are over 80.
I was actually briefly number one in Amazon for cults and Satanism, which was delightful.
Lovely thing to have. What else have we noticed?
So Boom Radio are doing brilliantly. So older audiences are massively underserved, and turns out if you actually care about them, then they come to you. And so they've had 662,000-ish people. So they are up 49.4% on last year. And they also, their hours are incredible. So they're having 11.7 hours, which is more than Radio 2 or local radio, who are probably their local.
So this is the average hours that people listen to a radio station. So obviously the more hours you give it, the more loyal you are to that station. So Boom listeners really love it. And why that's good is your times you reach by your average hours gets your total hours, and then that's what you're selling to the advertising market. And I was looking at their total hours for Boom, and it's bigger than Capital FM in London.
Wow.
I'm really chuffed for them. Good. It's a small team, and they really put their own money and experience into it, and it's just really nice to see people doing well. So
it's definitely, they spot a gap in the market and then just executed really well on it, didn't they? What else we got?
So a couple of small bits. So Virgin Radio overall are now at 1.5 million. And I remember a couple of years ago, they were really excited because they finally crossed the million mark when Chris Evans had come over. And I think, so again, I know some people really love to look at the quarter on quarter changes, but actually, if you're looking at long-term trends, like that's good news for them. Times Radio, I'm continually disappointed in how well Times Radio is doing compared with what it should be doing. They've got their lowest numbers that they've ever had. Now, to be fair, they've got 498,000, which I would be happy with. Like, we shouldn't turn up our noses at that.
It's nearly as big as the media pod.
Yeah, exactly. Really? Yeah. Yeah, they're right up there. Compared with last year there was a lot of political turmoil going on, so your reason to tune into that station would be more significant. I think that they have done a lot of work to improve the lineup and to create more texture on the station, because they've got Fee and Jane now, and like Matt Chorley's show has always done really well. But I do think, we're going to talk about social media later, I think their social media and they're attracting new people, and the awareness for their target audience is still not good, because people who are listening to LBC or Radio 4 should be being targeted very heavily for advertising and suggesting to swap over. Some of it is because of they're on D2, which is like, it doesn't have quite as much reach for DAB listeners as some of the other networks. But I just think there's an awareness problem, and considering how strong the journalism is in the newsroom, the print newsroom, the skills they've got on the radio team, and then the completely separate podcast department, it feels like there's just some lack of joined up stuff.
I think what's interesting about, it's a great radio station.
I think
everyone, when you talk to them about it, and they go, oh, their number's a bit soft, like they're doing a really good job, they're working really hard.
Yes.
James, how much do you think it is just the name and the connection, and people are a bit tribal with their newspapers? If they're not a reader, do they think, well, actually, maybe Times Radio isn't for me?
I think that might be it. But my suspicion is that it's more to do with the fact that Talk TV has had all of the exec attention and all the exec push. and actually I think is still in a very complicated position. It's hard to do TV as radio on air. The radio product has arguably suffered a bit. They've been playing around with the lineup, but also they spent so much on evening talent that the day was difficult. And sort of Times Radio has just been left to kind of do its own furrow. And again, everyone's been saying, not only is it good, it's been getting better. It's been finding its formats. You know, some of the people who hadn't done radio before are now quite experienced broadcasters. But I wonder whether it's that fact of sort of being a little bit the unloved stepchild. And I wonder, you know, if, as rumoured, there's a bit of a walk back and a scaling back of ambitions for Talk TV, whether actually that does open up a bit of scope for them to push Times Radio, maybe lean back into audio-led for both of them. Because I think there's space for both of them. I don't think Talk TV or Talk Radio, if they go back to it, is doing quite the same thing as LBC. And it's certainly not doing the same thing as Times Radio. So I do wonder if it's just actually they haven't really been giving it a push because you can only do so much at once. And, you know, you can't fault them on the scale of the ambition of what they were trying to do with Talk TV, even if perhaps they are going to have to rethink that.
I mean, the challenge of media, Anne, is we would all love this idea of, like, if you build it, they will come. But the world does not work like that anymore, does it?
No, well, I suppose nearly 500,000 people have come to a station that didn't exist a few years ago, so they have had some. On your point around TV stuff, I do have some bad and dangerous and wrong statistics that you should not do, but Adam Bowie's not here, so... as you pointed out, Talk Radio / TV's got more listeners than Times. But if you're looking across, because Talk and GB News are pretty much competitor products to each other. So if you...
For listeners, GB News, the TV channel, also simulcasts its output on the radio.
So if one's a TV channel that does radio, one's a radio that does TV.
So the point here is, if you do very, very bad things by comparing the latest Ray Jar Quarter with the August Barb figures, which is a telly, which you should not do, because they're calculated differently, but let's go for it. So in that case, Talk Radio / TV, Talk Radio is beating GB News in the audio format. It has way more listeners, but GB News is beating Talk TV in the TV format. So effectively, whatever your home format was, funnily enough, you're better at that than you are when you go and simulcast and the other thing. So.
Right. We continue to get lots of correspondence from listeners about the state of the TV industry for freelancers. After a year of a commissioning slowdown, producers, directors and crew are all short of work. And this week, the Film and TV Charity opens a survey to see the current state of workers in the sector. In our deep dive this week, we sent Ollie Peart to meet one such freelancer, Anna Collins, who's worked with Bear Grylls, SAS and Hunted. She's been a producer, director and more. Here's Anna.
So I've always been busy. I guess I'm normally away at least 10 months a year, working solidly all year. Often I'll finish a job on a Friday and start a new one on Monday, and that's it. I have no break at all, really. But yeah, this year is a bit different. This year is the worst year in TV history, in TV production history, bar COVID. Obviously, COVID was terrible. There was hardly any TV made for obvious reasons. But this year, it's almost as bad. It's to do with massive lack of commissioning. Most of the channels have decided to only commission 20% of their slate this year. So that means 80% of programmes are not being made. The entire industry is made up of freelancers. So that means 80% of people are out of work and have been all year. And that's a knock-on effect from several things post-COVID. So during COVID, as I said, no TV was made at all, really a fraction. I think it was 5% of television. So the year following COVID, we made so much TV to make up for the lack of content. We kind of shot ourselves in the foot because now the channels have so much stacked up on the shelves. They don't need to spend money this year making TV because they've got shows that haven't gone out yet. That tied in with the ad industry taking a massive dive in revenue. They can't afford to advertise on TV like they were. And also with the channels deciding to scrap programmes, for example, not bringing back The X Factor. Well, The X Factor brought in a huge audience, so obviously the ad slots for that were prime. Advertisers just don't have the confidence that they're going to get the viewing figures on the programmes that are going out at the moment to make it worthwhile advertising. So, yeah, chicken and egg.
I mean, short of commissioners turning around and going, well, we're going to commission a load of programmes, what would you like to see happen? What do you think needs to happen for, you know, people like you in the industry?
I think it's really easy. For example, the head of Channel 4, Ian Katz, made a comment earlier in the year telling freelancers to hold their nerve. Well, it's okay for him to hold his nerve, but you can't hold your nerve if you're self-employed and there is no work and there has been no work for months and months and months. Lots of people haven't worked at all or have worked sporadically since last December. Imagine not earning any money for 10 months, nothing. Like, how do you survive? So Ian saying, hold your nerve, followed by an announcement a few weeks ago saying, actually, Channel 4 are not going to make any new programmes until 2025. I mean, Channel 4 are a huge employer, and now they've got nothing going out.
From a personal perspective then, how are you feeling about the coming months, you know, and what are you doing personally to try and, I suppose, mitigate against not having any work come in?
Well, I am one of the lucky ones. I have been working a lot of the year. I've done 3 primetime shows this year. It has been sporadic in terms of length of contract compared with other years. But I mean, I've basically been working solidly since February. However, the documentary I'm on at the moment is murder dependent. And until there's unfortunately a new murder in the area that I'm covering, I'm not working. So, you know, I haven't done anything for a month now. But there may be a murder this afternoon and then I'm busy for the next few weeks.
Sure, but that uncertainty's got
exactly.
to be difficult.
And
do you, I mean, looking into the year ahead, you know, coming up to the end of the year, there must be some concern. Have you got any
booked? Yeah, I've got major concern. No, I've got nothing booked. Sometimes I book a year ahead. I've got nothing booked. And the thing about the TV industry and being freelance, and I know, you know, you've been freelance in the past, is when you're part of a crew, you really feel like part of a team. But when you're at home and there's no work coming in, you feel very alone. I'm on lots of director groups, so I know everybody's feeling the same. And like I said, I have been lucky and I have been working. But for people that haven't been working for months and months and months, or just had sporadic days here and there, it's a really lonely place. The freelance world is never a sure, you know, jobs are never a sure thing, but you get to a point in your career where work does come in. I mean, I've had 2 or 3 years in a row where I haven't had to apply for a single job. Although you can never fully relax, you get to a point in your career where, you know, that program's coming up, you'll be on it, you know, you've got that next summer, etc. So to have nothing in the diary and know that no one is commissioning anything is quite a frightening feeling.
I suppose they would turn around and say, well, you know, we haven't got the money, so...
They have the money, and, you know, there's been an uproar a few times this year where they've had to publish their bonuses. I think, again, it was Channel 4. You haven't made any TV this year, what's the bonus for? That money should go back into the pool and make TV. They're very short-sighted. They're thinking about this year. How can they save money this year? But what they're not thinking is the knock-on effect it's going to have this year, next year, the following year. Because people will switch off from terrestrial channels and then it will all be Amazon, Netflix, and you know, ITV will die, Channel 4 will die. And, you know, they're poisoning themselves at the moment. The answer is just commission some programmes.
That was Anna Collins speaking to Ollie Pitt. You can hear the full interview where Anna goes into more detail about the anger in the freelance community and what needs to be addressed if you are a member of our Patreon. You can find that and hours of more insight over on the Patreon, patreon.com/mediapod. Time for a break. We're back with more media news after this. Hello, media podcast listeners. Did you know there's a new episode of the New Europeans podcast available right now, featuring more from the journalist James Ball on misinformation or disinformation in the Middle East and how the media have got it right and wrong, plus Rishi's first year. Is it also his last? That's the New Europeans podcast, The Two Matts, with me, Matt Kelly.
And me, Matt D'Ancona. Find us in your podcast app right now. There's a link in the show notes.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work.
You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello again, Anne and James are back with me for some stories in brief. And the Daily Mail's owners have been revealing some of the secrets of their commercial success. This was at an ad upfront event for Mail Metro Media in London. James, what did you spot? What did they reveal?
It's essentially they were saying, hey, if we lose third-party cookies, which is sort of all the stuff Google uses or Facebook to try and decide what adverts to show you. You know, you've been looking at DFS, you go on the Mail, you see a sofa. They're saying if those go away, it's fine. And they started talking about having 3.1 trillion data points and user journeys and all of this. What they're really saying in, you know, cut away loads of marketing spiel is we know so much about what people do on the Mail website that we know enough to profile them without having to know the rest of it. You know, if someone goes on, clicks something in the sidebar and is looking, lingering on the pictures of the dresses and then sees a link to, you know, buy the look and clicks that, female fashion shopper, they're basically going, people spend enough time on our site that we can show good ads and you don't really have to panic and we can target ads well. And I believe them. They probably need to be a little bit careful about talking about all of this 3.1 trillion data points and endless tracking, because they should read their newsroom output a bit, because their newsroom gets incredibly angry at Google and Facebook doing this. And, you know, it's a bit, you know, fish in a barrel to kind of go, guys, what you're really saying is we can guess who you are when you look at the Mail, which most people will be chill with. The Mail is collecting 3.1 trillion data points in its readers. I could turn into a great Daily Mail story.
Anne, how do you feel about the end of third-party cookies?
Well, it's not quite the end of third-party cookies. They're changing the way that Google is changing the way it's doing them or dealing with them if you're on the Chrome browser. So this is all a little bit of an overlap between wars between Google, Apple and Facebook in general. And also I think people like the Mail might be building their own data set to say, well, we've got this so other advertisers can come and use it. So the kind of the use of data, that overlap between that and the competition authorities saying, actually, we shouldn't be building up so that you can only do online advertising with one or two major suppliers. And then things like GDPR, because obviously international companies like Facebook or Meta, as is now, a lot of those are based in the States, and the American regulations around data privacy and tracking are much more lax than they are in Europe with GDPR or things in Canada like CAN-SPAM. Mm. So different companies are coming up with different approaches for dealing with this, and technology's changed over time. So Apple a little while ago had quite a blanket sort of thing of trying to stick one up at Meta, I think, where they said, in the latest updates, you can now choose, you know, when you have an app and it says, do you want to be tracked or not? And funnily enough, most people are like, oh, no, thank you, I'd rather not. But then Apple's business isn't really about selling the data in that way. So Google's changing how it's approaching the data handling because they are still selling advertising. And so instead of having a reliance on tracking on a third party website so that you as the customer get a lot of the data, they will still be doing the adverts in a really targeted way, but you will, as the consumer, will be processing the choices on your device. So it will still be very personalized advertising. It's just that the advertiser won't have access to the data about you in the same way, which means that they avoid the issue of what's called fingerprinting, which is a bit, for journalists, is a bit like jigsaw identification, but the tech version. So you accidentally, you working out that, oh, it's actually Matt who's looking at the, you know,
it's just to add a tiny dollop of extra cynicism on top of that. So the way Google is going to implement it is a bit better for user privacy. It means your data is going to less places. I think one of the things we don't quite realize is you visit a website, it's not that website that sees your sort of data. Some of it goes to hundreds potentially of ad networks, and bits of it could go to thousands of brands, and that's for each click. You know, we don't quite realize. And so that trimming in with Google is good, but the way they're doing it is in a way that will slightly favor their own ad. They have to open it up in certain ways to other advertisers, but they give themselves a home court advantage. Apple did exactly the same thing with Ask Not to Track. It came just as they launched their own advertising wing. And Apple is now, I think, either the fourth or the fifth biggest advertising company in the world.
I mean, this is sometimes...
always cynical.
But this is sometimes Apple pretends, well, we really care about security, we care about your data. And I think they do, but also we also have a lot of benefits now you're locked into our ecosystem.
Yes, but also in this instance, they have started being an ad platform and an ad agency. They are much more respectful of privacy and user data than the industry norm. But, you know, they know how to make money. They're a very profitable business.
I had a great conversation this week with someone in California, and they were very annoyed that they had to basically start again with their email database because California has much stronger data protection than the rest of America. And I was like, yes, we've had this for quite a while. Yes. We are more used to it. And actually, I felt oddly proud that, that our data, that our GDPRs can actually be pretty good for consumers if done correctly.
It's although I'm a trustee of the Media Society. Mm. And so it's a charity, 50 years old. Harry Evans set it up. We do events. The most recent was looking at the ethics and the difficulties of reporting Israel Hamas. All very nice. If you sign up and come to an event, we can't add you to the mailing list. A little things like that of going, you know, might you want an email once a month going, here's the next event we're doing. Try convincing the platform that they can transfer the emails to the email platform. Yeah. It's completely legitimate interest, but we can't.
But also it's a good example, isn't it? Because back to the large media companies, the large digital companies, they've got the scale to do this. Quite a lot of them like new rules because it stops new entrants being able to really play in this space too.
Yes. And actually GDPR, a lot like PECA actually, which is the email communications regulations, and cookie directives, they tend to just create compliance barriers. Mm. And so what you see is they make life a lot easier for big business who is then actually not that averse to strengthening or changing them. And you will also see, as each new one comes, there's a sort of wave of consultants that will terrify smaller businesses because the laws usually actually have some relatively good carve-outs for little places. But usually that doesn't help because bigger companies that operate their services go cautious, or they end up paying tens of thousands to people to be told they're compliant. Who scared them? They don't help.
Well, there's no compliance barriers for the media quiz, which this week is entitled The Elevator Pitch. As we all know, any new format or storyline is merely a combination of two or more existing media properties. So to put that to the test, I'll give you an elevator pitch for a show that's been announced this week. You just tell me what the show is. Buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So Anne, you will say...
Anne.
And James, you will say...
James.
Let's play the elevator pitch. Right, question number one. It's Shaun of the Dead meets the Generation Game.
Anne,
what is it?
Generation Z.
Yes.
Which I presume stands for zombie because it's about grandmas who become zombies and start infecting their grandchildren or something.
It's where infected elderly attack gangs of teenagers in a satire on the generation gap from Ben Wheatley.
Cool.
are you up for that?
I want some escapism from television. That just feels like, you know, British politics.
So how does it work then? The grandparents all like emerge from their massive houses and the children have to defend themselves with avocado toast.
Very much.
To be fair, just throwing avocados at pensioners could be a great TV format.
One point, Anne. Question number two. It's like Nikki Campbell in Australia with some Irish talk show host glamour.
That's got to be Graham Norton in some ways.
You need to buzz in.
I don't know.
That's close
don't
to
know
a
your
buzz
name.
In.
James, the Graham Norton World Show.
It's you're on the right track.
Wheel of Fortune, which is the weirdest thing ever because it's like an American show with an Irish TV host based in the UK but going to Australia.
Yes.
Can I cheat and claim that because you didn't say
you
that?
You get half a point each.
I was helping you.
I
needed the pity.
You're absolutely right. This is Whispers Wheel of Fortune Australia for Network 10 with host Graham Norton.
I mean, Graham's amazing,
is
but
that,
I don't
is
understand
that the title?
This.
Yeah, it should be.
Because if that's the title, that's going to take like a whole half hour to air. Yeah.
I think he's a great choice for Wheel of Fortune.
Oh, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why he's doing Wheel of Fortune Australia. That's the bit I don't...
No,
great
he's a,
presenter.
He's a great host,
but,
yeah.
But, also, it's one of those things that they probably film about 900 episodes over a period of like 7 days, don't
yeah.
they? Yeah. So fly him over, spin yeah. that wheel 1 million times, yeah. Take home the cash.
Go to the physio for some RSI from spinning it too
yes.
much. And then yeah.
I quite miss Wheel of Fortune. Yeah. I'd be up for some new Wheel of yeah. Fortune.
Maybe a repitch yourself. Who knows? right, question number three. What if Barry Norman had hosted a podcast with his daughter?
Anne.
Oh, I know this one.
This is the poorly named for search recognition Real Talk.
Yes.
Can I just see if I actually knew it? Is yep. it the one Jonathan Ross is doing with his daughter?
Yes.
I actually knew something. Okay. I didn't
we should
know
share
name.
That one. We should
no,
share that
no.
one.
No, yeah. no. I mean, you've won anyway.
Real Talk, yeah, not very searchable. There's probably 900 other podcasts called it.
Well, once you realise that it's real as in cinema real, then it might be easier to pop up. But you do have to have that explained. So as a punny name does not work for an audio format is my suggestion. But there you go.
I bet they're going to do Real Talk with Jonathan Ross very quickly as well. Just for the search.
Probably. I think this is one of the challenges sometimes with talent-led podcasts. And big stars often like working with family members. And I'm sure his daughter is brilliant at it. But is this an idea that suits him rather than suits the audience?
Well, they've put in the publicity. They're putting her name first. So whether they're trying to introduce that you
yeah,
know, to a
yeah.
younger audience.
Potentially.
Yeah. But I mean, I feel that at this stage in podcasting, you need an idea that's stronger than two people talk about movies.
And also, Jonathan Ross is a great person to talk about movies. And
of course, he's very qualified.
I'm sure his daughter is too. But yeah, it's not necessarily got an amazing format, yeah. I imagine.
Because, I mean, look, I understand you could obviously say that about Commode and Mayo going yep. over to podcast, but they had the show, had the audience, had the format.
And the relationship, people have
yeah.
relationship.
And that, you know, that all carries over. That's different from saying, let's start from scratch. Even with a name who knows about his, he really does know about his movies, it just does seem a little bit like it's going to do 8 episodes and then they're going to give up. But I hope it goes better.
Absolutely. Anne, congratulations. You're the winner of the quiz. 2.5 points for you. It's a half a point. and as your prize, you get to listen to that podcast and say that we're all wrong and actually it's pretty good and we should all
tune
in.
With pleasure.
My thanks to Anne Charles, James Ball and Anna Collins. Anne, how can people keep up with what you're doing?
I am on annecharles.tv is my website, or radiotechcon.com to come to TechCon, or I am at SparkyAnneC on various social media platforms.
And James?
So you can find me in the New European every week, or on social media, you can find me on the flaming wreckage of the site formerly known as Twitter, at JamesRBUK.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And that's it from us today at the London Podcast Studios. Remember, you can get 25% off your first booking when you use the code MEDIAPOD at thelondonpodcaststudios.com. That's MEDIAPOD at thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off. And please tell your colleagues about us, but only the nice ones. We can only continue to make this show if we have the great and the good of the media industry listening. But let's keep the arseholes out. Send them to podfollow.com/themediapodcast. And actually, I was having a look at the Apple Podcast reviews from the show. They're a bit odd. I'm not saying they aren't true or that those people really believed what they said, but if you really like the show, perhaps you'd like to leave a review. Just go to Apple Podcasts and pop one in. I would love to read what you have to say. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill with support from Ollie Pitt. It was a Rethink Audio production, and I'll see you next week.
Out. normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.